You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. This week, From the Bookshelf remembers two great artists, America's great historian and storyteller David McCullough, who died on August 7th, 2022, at the age of 89, and the great singer and actress Olivia Newton-John, who died on August 8th at age 73. Today, we listen back to interviews with both these legends. Olivia Newton-John was one of the most successful recording artists of the 20th century. She was a four-time Grammy Award winner with five number one hits and another 10 top 10 hits. She sold more than 100 million records, and she was also a movie star whose films include the classic Grease and the now revered Xanadu with Gene Kelly. I interviewed Olivia Newton-John in 2019 on the occasion of the publication of her memoir, Don't Stop Believin'. Olivia Newton-John, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. How are you, Gary?
I'm great. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to thank you for writing your book. I think your experiences with cancer will be enormously helpful to people. And I don't mean just cancer patients. So I think everyone. I really appreciated how you described why you wanted the word wellness added to the name of the cancer center named for you.
Yes, it was really important to me because I think, you know, when you hear the word cancer and they tell you that you have cancer, obviously it's very frightening. But if you're going to have therapy and you go to the hospital and you see the word wellness next to cancer, it gives you hope that you can get there, you can achieve that. And I think that's really important. It's a hopeful thing and a very positive thing.
And, you know, I think I felt that in your book. It's a very positive and marvelous book. Just judging from your picture on it, you look so fantastic in it.
Thank you.
Last year, there was an album by Juliana Hatfield. She's one of those indie rock
people. Right. Oh, I know her. Yeah, she did all my songs.
Yeah, she recorded an album of your songs.
That was very sweet. Yeah.
Surprise.
Very surprising by someone like her, but it was very sweet.
Do you like the record?
Yes, I haven't heard all of it, but I've heard a few tracks, and I thought they were really fun.
It's weird for somebody to do all of your songs.
It was a different thing to do, but I think it's lovely that she did that.
Well, I of course, have some favorite Olivia Newton-John albums. My favorite is Soul Kiss, and I just love staring at that album cover when I'm listening to it. In fact, I have to be honest, I stare at that cover of Soul Kiss no matter what album I'm listening to.
You're funny. Is that the one with my curly hair in black and white?
Yeah.
Oh, that was Helmut Newton. And Helmut Newton, do you know who he is?
I do. Great photographer.
Yeah, very famous photographer. He was actually a friend of my father's, and he took photographs of my sister when she was 16 when she first became a model. So he was a family friend. And I remember doing that album shoot, and I never felt quite comfortable with that. It's funny. But now I look back, I really appreciate the photos.
Well, so I wonder, you had some trepidation at the time about posing in this way.
For those five
people who haven't seen it, you're standing on the back with your riding pants on and your crop.
And a crop.
But you forgot your shirt. You don't have your shirt on.
That's right. And I was Heidi Klum actually copied that photo for something years ago. So I thought, oh, well, that's cool.
No, I think that's very artistic. I thought it was great when it came out. When I worked at a record store then, and we unboxed it, and we said, "This is Olivia Newton-John."
It was my bold days, yeah. The bold old days.
Now, in your book, one of the things I love in your book was we talked about Karen Carpenter, and you had some really warm thoughts about her, and you described your friendship. And you also mentioned John Denver, another of the stars who's passed away. But I wonder if, you know, I know you performed with John Denver and he wrote one of your first hits. Do you remember meeting him?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I had my first Thanksgiving with John and Annie when he was married to Annie.
Right.
And he was a dear friend to me, and he had me on his special in Aspen, and we spent some time together. He was a lovely man, so gifted. What an amazing songwriter and singer.
Do you still ride, I wonder?
Ride? No, not for the last year anyway.
Yes, the horses on the back of your album, they look too small to ride.
Yeah, they're miniatures. They're no choices. I don't know if you've read the book yet, but
yes, I have.
I talk about how, you know, now I have to be satisfied with miniature horses and table tennis, and that's fine.
No more real tennis, no more riding around. But horses and animals have always been an important part of your life.
Oh, absolutely. Love animals. And, they're just so loving, unconditional love and fun and being in the moment and the earth. They're just a constant reminder. You know, a dog is God backwards, so that's perfect.
Oh, I think this is a wonderful book. What made you decide to write your memoir now?
It was interesting because I had no real plans to write a book, but then I heard that they were doing a movie of my life in Australia, and I wasn't involved in the making of it, and I didn't really like the idea, so I thought I better write a book because I don't know what they're going to say or how they're going to interpret, you know, my life. So that was the inspiration, and I'm glad because it got me going, and then the movie turned out to be fine. Delta Goodrum, who's a dear friend of mine, played me. And I didn't watch it yet because I can't watch myself or things about myself, but I hear it was fine. But at least it inspired the book.
Now, on the cover of your book, you are in the exact pose and wearing pretty much the exact clothes as on your album, If You Love Me, Let Me Know.
Right. It wasn't planned that way, but that's how it ended up.
Really? It's just a coincidence?
Yeah, really, because I was doing a photo shoot for a magazine. And those clothes were given to me by the magazine, and then when we were looking for a photo for the book, originally it was going to be one with the little horses, but everyone preferred the one in the denim shirt, and I didn't really realize until later how similar they were.
Oh, I mean the tree is in the same spot.
Oh, is it really? Oh, wow.
I thought, oh, that's so clever that she's done her album.
Trees have a way of doing that, don't they?
Let's talk a little bit about Greece. You spend quite a bit of time in your book talking about it, especially the pants. Now, describe for my listeners how you got those pants on and off.
Well, those pants were old already because we filmed the movie in the 70s, and the pants were from the 50s. So they were already 20-something years old, and the zip was broken. So rather than try and fix them because we were concerned it might damage the fabric, they just stitched me in. And so that was challenging on a hot day. what I'm excited about is I'm going to be auctioning off the pants and the jacket for my hospital.
Oh, when will that take place?
Yeah, sometime this year we're doing a big auction, so I'm very excited about that.
Well, that should draw millions of dollars.
That's what I'm hoping, yep.
Won't you miss having the pants and the jacket around? I mean, imagine you put them on from time to time and dance.
No, around. I don't. I don't want to know. Well, the jacket, yes, but the pants, I'm not so sure. No, I think I'll be very happy knowing that somebody has them that really wanted them, and more importantly, that the money is raised for my wellness programs at my hospital. So that's what I want it for.
Now, I know you still perform a lot, and in your book you talk about that you have no intention of ever stopping. But what about acting? Do you still want to do some acting?
I don't really know, and I don't know if you read the book with the new chapter in it. Where I'm in my hospital for my birthday, is it?
No, that wasn't in my book. Oh,
really? The last chapter? Is it a softback or a hardback?
It's a hardback, but...
From America?
Yeah. Oh, I better
That's
check
really
again.
Strange. Okay. well, I don't know that I'll perform again. Not sure now, because I've taken 6 months off since I had my fractured pelvis, so I had to learn to walk again, and a walker and then a cane, and now I'm walking without, but I've had time to just be home and be with my family and my animals, and I'm not sure about concerts anymore. I have to really think deeply about that. So I'm just taking more time off right now and loving it.
What about recording? You think you'll make a new record?
Don't know. I don't know yet.
You are a songwriter and a really fine songwriter, although most of your hits were written by other people.
But yeah, thank you.
Do you have a lot of songs that are rattling around in your head?
I have a few that I've had for years and years and years and never been able to finish, so I would like to finish them, but I'm not sure about a project. If I did any kind of project singing, I would probably do something with my daughter because we've talked about doing that. We'd had one hit record together, a disco song, but she has a lovely voice, and so we have talked about it, but I'm not sure.
You know, when you were a star, not that you're not a star now, but I mean, when you rose to fame in the 1970s, it was a period of time when most of the rock stars did a lot of cocaine and ran around. And, but you never partook?
No, I wasn't interested in drugs. I'd see it around me, but it wasn't anything I was interested in. And no, I wasn't part of that culture. Now I use a lot of cannabis for my pain and sleep and inflammation. My husband grows it and makes it for me.
And is it working for you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely amazing. And it also helped me because I was on, they gave me morphine when I was in a lot of pain in hospital. And opiates are very hard to get off, as you, I'm sure you know.
Sure.
And the cannabis has helped me wean off the morphine. So I'm very, very grateful to cannabis. And I think that there's been a lot of talk about it, and I'm living proof that it works to wean off a dangerous drugs with something that's safe.
So you're fully in favor of the legalization of marijuana?
I am, yes. Particularly for, you know, people who are in pain and suffering and, you know, whatever reason. You're not going to die from it, whereas you die from these opiate drugs and these prescription medicines. And there's been no recording in history of anyone dying from cannabis. So we all have a cannabidiol, we have a body inside us that relates to that, to cannabis. It's been with us for centuries. So it's an important thing, and there are thousands of papers now on research as to what it can do for epilepsy, for Parkinson's, for glaucoma, all kinds of things. It's helping with so many things. We haven't even scratched the surface of the wonders of this plant and the different strains. So I'm obviously an advocate.
Oh, do you think you're, was there any rock and roll peer pressure from your contemporaries back in the day?
Oh, to smoke cannabis? Not really. I mean, it was around me too, but I wasn't that interested. And I tried it a few times in my youth, but didn't really like it. So it isn't something that I have used in my life until this time, and until I was married to John, who's a plant medicine man and understands the healing benefits and the medicinal benefits of it. So I've got to really appreciate it and watched it grow in our own little greenhouse and watch my husband make it for me. So I'm very grateful to it.
And you identify, even though you were born in England, you definitely identify as being Australian.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, you're an Aussie.
I sound like one, don't I?
Yeah, you do, you do. Did you have a British accent when you got there?
Well, when I was five and I got to Australia, I don't really know what kind of accent. I think you're still forming at that point, so I think I picked up the Aussie accent pretty quickly. My sister, however, because she was older, she remained with an English accent all her life because she was, you know, she left England later in her life.
Well, another album I want to ask you about, because I've got all your albums sitting here looking at them, is Physical. Now, was there some trepidation on your part about doing that song or that album?
Well, you know, when I first recorded Physical, I just thought it was a great song. And then after I'd recorded it with John Farrar and Steve Kepner, both really great friends of mine, I kind of panicked a little bit and thought I'd gone too far and called my manager and said, "Hey, I think I've gone too far. We've got to pull this song." He said, "It's too late. It's gone to radio." And, of course, it went on to be one of my biggest hits in my life. And I was banned, which now I see as a badge of honor, but at the time it was embarrassing. but, you know, at that time I thought, well, we better do a video, I think, because then we do a video about exercise. It's going to take the onus off the other thing. Well, of course, it just made it bigger. And just
nobody was fooled, Olivia.
No, it makes me laugh, doesn't it, I think about it.
And it was one of your biggest hits. But not, you know, when you listen to all of your music, it's not so much a departure. I think it was just the idea that you were getting physical.
Yeah, I know. It was a little raunchy at the time, but compared to what's on the radio now, it's kind of like a lullaby, is what I say.
You worked with one of my idols, Gene Kelly.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Oh, he was lovely. He, you know, he's a gentleman. He was incredibly brilliant, of course, and the fact that I danced his last dance with him is pretty amazing for me.
Was he a nice guy?
Yeah, lovely man.
Now, I know he really was a, he really wanted to perfect his dances and so on. Did he drive you hard in rehearsal?
Yeah, he did. We rehearsed a lot, and then when we filmed that sequence, he only wanted the cameraman, the lighting and sound. He didn't want a set full of people. And he directed that segment himself, and he didn't want the director there, and just the choreographer and the you know, the key people that needed to be in the room. So it was private, which was great for me because it was a little scary to dance with him, as you can imagine.
I can kind of imagine.
Yeah.
This book is a marvelous book. It's called Don't Stop Believing. Olivia Newton-John. I don't, do I say it, Olivia Newton-John, Don't Stop Believing, or Don't Stop Believing?
Yeah, either way. Oh, Don't Stop Believing In.
And I want to thank you for writing it. I think it's a very brave book.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a very interesting journey. You know, a lot of things, I mean, I wrote about things I remember. A lot of things I don't, I guess, because I thought of stories later that I went, I forgot that one. But I think I picked out the ones that I thought people would want to know about. And that's the beauty of writing your own book. You get a choice of what you put in there or not.
Maybe the cannabis is affecting your memory.
No, I think it helps it.
Well, it's just been a real thrill for me to talk to you. Thank you so much for being my guest on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Olivia Newton-John from 2019. She died on August 8th at the age of 73. When we return, we will listen back to my interview with historian David McCullough. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Maybe I hang around here a little more than I should. We both know I got somewhere else to go. I got something to tell you that I never thought I would. But I believe you really ought to know. I love you. I honestly love you.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. David McCullough, who died on August 7th, 2022, at the age of 89, was one of our greatest historians, as well as a narrator and television host. He was a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, and in 2006 was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom. In his books, David McCullough told the stories of the Johnstown Flood, Harry Truman, John Adams, Theodore Roosevelt, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Panama Canal, and the Wright Brothers. McCullough also narrated numerous documentaries, such as The Civil War by Ken Burns, as well as the 2003 film Seabiscuit. When we spoke in 2016, his book on the Wright brothers had just been published, and American Pharoah had just become the first horse to win the Triple Crown since 1978. Well, were you excited to see American Pharoah win the Triple Crown?
Oh, yes, of course. That was quite a moment.
It really was. He's a great horse.
Well, I've never seen a horse out that far in front, I don't think, in any race. But it was a spectacle for all of us who saw it.
Well, so Orville Wright, he was the first man to fly a plane, and he lived to see jet planes break the sound barrier. Why do you think there was such an extraordinary acceleration of technology in the 20th century?
Well, it began really in the 19th century with a surge of innovation and invention that changed the whole way of life. And most all of it happened here in our own country. The advent of the telephone, the light bulb, the elevator, which made possible the high-rise buildings, skyscrapers, the mousetrap, all came within a period of about 30 years. And once it got going, it just picked up increasing speed, but the advance of aviation after the Wright brothers first flew at Kitty Hawk, or I should say after the world suddenly recognized that they really could fly, which didn't happen until 1908, the acceleration of aviation technology exceeded anything anyone ever imagined, including the Wright brothers. Now, Wilbur Wright, alas, died much too young, in his mid-40s, in 1912. But Orbel lived to see the advent of jet propulsion and rockets and airplanes flying the Atlantic Ocean, which he never, ever imagined, nor did had his brother. But alas, also, of course, the use of the airplane as a weapon of not just war, but of mass destruction and killing, which broke his heart and would have broken Wilbur's heart had he lived. But he, at the same time, as he said, it's like the invention of fire. It can be good or used for good or evil, but it's up to us. And while it may seem a long, long time ago that 1903, 1905, and it was more than 100 years ago, as history goes, that's not very far back at all. And Wilbur didn't die until Orville didn't die until 1948. I could have known him. If I'd grown up in Dayton, Ohio, in the same neighborhood, he would have been that nice old fellow around the corner that was so pleasant to say hello to. I was 15 in 1948. And yet, I could have known the first human being ever to have flown.
And you also saw someone walk on the moon.
Who lived to see someone walk? I lived to see it. He didn't live to see it. But I think it's fascinating, and maybe not just coincidental, that the first human being ever to take to the air in a machine-powered flying device, and the first human being ever to set foot on the moon, both came from the same section of southwestern Ohio.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, he was carrying with him, as a token of respect and a sense of history, a small swatch of the canvas from the one of the wings of the Wright biplane that famously flew at Kitty Hawk in 1903.
Well, it is just really amazing that you can, you know, the very first flight after thousands of years of people looking up at birds thinking, I'd like to fly, and in, you know, basically one man's lifetime, we get to the moon. How did they solve that riddle?
Well, one of the ways they did it was to study the birds. As Orville later said, learning the secret of flight from a soaring bird was like learning a magic trick from a magician. The birds were the magicians, and they studied what they were doing, and they saw that these soaring birds, the wondrous soaring birds like the gannet with wingspans of 5 or 6 feet, could stay up there. Once they got up, they could stay up there without flapping their wings at all. How did they do that? Well, they were riding the wind. And they were able to bank and turn because of the way they twisted the ends of their wings, the tips of their wings. And when the brothers first got to Kitty Hawk on the beaches of the Outer Banks of North Carolina and saw these birds in multitudes and went out onto the beach and tried to copy or imitate the motions of the birds with their wings, twisting their wrists and hands and arms up and down the beaches, the local people thought they were absolutely wacko, and quite understandably. But the Wrights figured out what they called wing warping, whereby they could twist the wing and bank and turn. But they also did something of infinite importance to understand. It wasn't just that they invented the airplane, but they learned to fly it. And Wilbur liked to say that there are two ways to train an untamed horse. One is to sit on the fence and study all of its activities and go back to a comfortable chair at home and write a thesis about how to tame a wild horse. The other is to get on the horse and ride it. They got on the machines that they built, first a series of gliders and then their motorized glider, and flew it. Now, that was a very, very dangerous thing to do, and they knew it. They weren't just ingenious to an extreme, but they were brave, courageous men, because every time they went up on a test flight, they knew perfectly well that each of them stood a chance of being killed. And it wasn't just that they went up two or three times. They go up 50 times in a year or more. So we have to acknowledge not just that they were brilliant, and Wilbur, the older of the two, was unquestionably a genius. There's no doubt about it. Orville was very innovative mechanically and very bright. But Wilbur had a reach of mind quite beyond the normal. But in addition to that, they had fantastic courage, and they would not give up when things went wrong. If they were knocked down, they didn't lie there and whimper and lapse into self-pity or blame other people. They got back up and tried to figure out what had they done wrong. What could they do that wouldn't happen again? And there wasn't just physical setbacks, like mosquito attacks or hurricanes or all the other things that happened on the Outer Banks, but there were the intellectual challenges that they had to face. The discovery, for example, that all the previous data used by specialists in the science or the technology of aviation were wrong. And they learned that because they were flying, whereas the other people were just theorists. And therefore, they had to create their own data. They had to create their own wind tunnel. They had to make their own little models of the airplane wings out of hacksaw blades. They had to build their own gasoline engine because nobody in the country yet made an engine that was light enough in weight but yet strong enough to serve their purpose. They'd never built a motor before in their lives.
We're talking with David McCullough about his new book, The Wright Brothers. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. One of the great critiques of socialism and communism is that forms of government like that lack the incentive that capitalism provides. But with Wilbur and Orville Wright, they didn't seem particularly interested or they weren't particularly driven by the quest for financial success. They just wanted to fly because they wanted to fly?
Exactly. They were not in it for the money. They were not in it certainly for the celebrity. They did not like the limelight. They tried to avoid it if they possibly could. I don't think it had to do with either capitalism or socialism. They would have objected to socialism just as much as they objected to anybody else owning them or controlling them. They were like a painter or a sculptor or a composer. They were creative people, and they wanted to work on their own in their own way, and they did. They had no financial backer. They had no great university supporting their experiments or Smithsonian Institution. All they had was their own idea and their own sense of purpose. And they were convinced they could succeed if they could live to tell the tale. And their independence, I think, was of the utmost importance to them because it gave them the chance to think independently, to not have to explain everything to somebody else, who probably wouldn't get it, even if they did explain it to them. They lived in their own world with their own high purpose. And they were also very confident that if they could live through it, they could do it.
How did their past as bicycle repairmen or bicycle, they were makers of bicycles, how did that help in their flying?
Well, it helped enormously in that they learned how to make things superbly. They made beautiful bicycles. They did make them in a little shop behind where they sold parts and pieces for bicycles and bicycles themselves. And that shop still exists. It's at the Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. Hmm. And you go there and you realize this is where it all happened, this little workshop. And they were skilled makers of beautiful machinery, which is very important to understand. But also, a bicycle is something you have to learn to ride by riding it. You can't read a little article about how to ride a bicycle and get on and ride it. And a bicycle requires balance. And that's exactly the case with what they were going to do with their flying machine. They had to learn to fly it by flying it, and it would require balance. And in aviation, the balance is known as equilibrium. It's like an athletic feat or an acrobatic feat. You have to know how to balance on the wind, not balance on the road, on the ground underneath you, the way a bicycle, but with the wind. And that was an art form. That was a physical dance step that very few people even imagined having to learn to do correctly.
You talk about some of the other inventors briefly. You mentioned Alexander Graham Bell a couple of times in the book. Were those inventors jealous? Did they want to kind of get in on the flight thing?
Yes, they did. They all tried. Edison tried. Alexander Graham Bell tried. A number of people in Europe, particularly in France, were trying. And none of them succeeded, really. Or let's say that they were way behind the Wrights, way behind, as the French aviators, pioneer aviators, all acknowledged. Once Wilbur brought his flying machine to France and demonstrated for the French, for crowds of people, for the world, that human beings could fly. And that didn't happen until 1908, 5 years after they first flew at Kitty Hawk. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. The world simply would not accept that man could fly. Everybody knew man can't fly. And so here was somebody doing it, and still the world refused to believe it or even bother to go out and take a look.
They were just sure it couldn't happen.
It couldn't happen. These were a couple of wackos, a couple of loonies, who were claiming something that everybody knew couldn't possibly be done.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are listening back this week to my 2016 interview with historian David McCullough, who passed away on August 7th at the age of 89. Well, they are kind of unusual characters. They're two men who they weren't college educated. They never married. Well, I don't know. Was there something wrong with them?
Well, some people thought so, and I suppose some people will continue to think so, but no, there wasn't anything wrong with them. They had a mission, not unlike a religious mission or a mission to climb some supposedly unclimbable mountain. They had a high purpose, and it all goes back to how they were raised, how they were brought up by their father. Their mother had died when they were quite still in their teenage. The father was an itinerant minister, devoted to his religious cause. But he raised them to have purpose in life. He also educated them in a way that we really ought to take a closer look at. As you said, neither ever went to college, but both of them were very well educated in the liberal arts. They grew up in a house that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no telephone, no electricity, but was a house full of books. And the books included the best of English literature, included Dickens and Hawthorne and Mark Twain, but also included the poetry of Virgil, Thucydides, Plutarch's Lives, and history, and natural history, and two sets of encyclopedias. And they were encouraged, stimulated to read everything and to learn to use the English language, not just correctly, but effectively. And they were superb writers, and as a consequence, their private correspondence, family letters, have survived. They are over 1,000 in number. Those are the two brothers, the father, and the younger sister, Catherine, whose importance to the story has been too long underestimated. And one of the joys of writing this book is to bring her front and center to the place that she deserves in the story. I don't think it would have come out the way it did had it not been for her. But in any event, they were all raised in the full liberal arts tradition, educated in the full liberal arts tradition. Now today we have too many students who are being encouraged to sidestep the liberal arts because they want to go into science or technology. Isn't it interesting that these two men who achieved a technical advance far beyond anything ever imagined, far beyond the most brilliant innovation and minds of the in the history of the world, including Leonardo da Vinci. These two men, who had no technical training, no technical education, but were steeped in the liberal arts, did it because they saw what they were doing in a bigger context than just what they were making. They saw it as an expression of human creativity at its most positive. And they were very interested in art and music. They each played a musical instrument. They were interested in architecture. They read everything. Orville loved Hawthorne. Catherine loved Sir Walter Scott. Wilbur, the genius of the brothers, loved everything, read everything. And his letters from France about the wonders of the great Gothic architectural masterpieces of France, his letters describing which paintings he found most moving or fascinating at the Louvre, are an open window to a sense of the full realm reach of human creativity.
How do you think they became interested, particularly in flight?
That's a very good question, and we don't quite know. We do know that Bishop Wright had in his house library several very powerful volumes about ornithology, and written with great poetic eloquence, translations of French authors. And we do know that Wilbur had read those books. And we do know that he suffered an accident, a hockey game, as a teenager that caused him to lose all of his upper front teeth. He was hit in the face with a hockey stick. And he went into a kind of depression period afterward, where he imposed a sort of self-imposed seclusion at home. And during that time, he intended to go to college. He wanted to go to Yale, and he probably would have gone. But this accident caused a great swerve in his career path, and he stayed home, and it was then he started reading as never before, and conceivably even got a better education than he would had he gone to college. But in any event, in 1899, he sat down at a little desk in the front parlor belonging to his sister Catherine and wrote a letter to the Smithsonian Institution saying he was ambitious to work on a flying machine, and would they please send him everything they had on aviation. Very, very important letter. One of the most important letters in history. And the Smithsonian responded, gave him a complete reading list, sent him articles that had been published by the Smithsonian, and he was on his way. And the next thing, they were building kites to fly, and then ultimately started building their own gliders. Huge things, biggest gliders ever built up until then.
We're chatting with historian David McCullough. His new book is The Wright Brothers. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Now, you mentioned their sister, and she plays quite a role in your story, and she's the first woman, for instance, to ever fly in a plane. You just kind of touch a little bit on the book that Orville, by this time Wilbur had passed away, but Orville was distressed when his sister married?
Yes, my book really ends in 1910, 2 years before Wilbur's death, when at last they put on an air show, if you will, at home in Dayton, and the two of them got in the plane and went up together, something they had never done, because if one of them got killed, the other had to be alive to continue with their quest. But they were signaling to their hometown and to themselves that they'd done it. They'd achieved what they wanted to achieve, and they were going up to enjoy the thrill of flight together for the first time.
It's a great moment.
But in the epilogue, I write about the fact that Catherine, fairly late in life, announced to Orville that she was going to be married to a man that they both knew quite well. She had gone to Oberlin College, unlike her brother. She'd gone to college and served later on the board of directors for the college and had met this man and gotten to know him. A very fine fellow who was an editor of the Kansas City Star. And Orville was so stunned by this news and so crushed by it because he thought they were going to be together forever, for the rest of their lives, and he felt, unfortunately, sadly, that she had betrayed him. And he had suffered, was known in the family all along to have had his peculiar spells when he would get very touchy and sulky. And this was his worst of all peculiar spells. He refused to speak to her. And alas, it was as painful for her as anything that had ever happened. She did get married. And it wasn't too long after several years, but after she got married, that she became deathly ill and was dying. And he wouldn't even go to her bedside until the very last minute he did get there before she passed on. But it was almost unbelievably selfish of him and cruel, painful for his beloved sister. But we can't explain it, and that's what happened.
Yeah. So was at the end of his life, what was Orville like? Was he a crotchety old man?
No, he was a wonderful fellow.
Yeah.
He was very quiet. He was very shy. Had been all his life. He kept flying for years and was flying planes with pontoons and flying monoplanes, one-wing planes, and went down one time the Miami River in Dayton and almost got killed again. But he loved automobiles, and he was famous in Dayton for driving at very high speeds, and the police would look the other way because they didn't want to do anything to deter the enthusiasm of this famous old gentleman. He was a delightful man in many ways, very charming, very interesting, well-read, and, of course, the first human being ever to have flown.
You know, you do such a marvelous job of creating the world that they live in your book and in all your books. When did you become a historian? You studied English, but when did you decide to become a historian?
Well, it happened when I was in my late 20s. I'd gone to work with the call of our president to serve our country. I'd given up a job I had with Time and Life in New York and went to Washington to be part of the new frontier, as we called it. And in the Kennedy years, I worked for the U.S. Information Agency. And part of my job had led me to doing some research at the Library of Congress in their great prints and photographs collection. And it was then that I ran into some photographs of taken in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, shortly after the dam broke and the calamitous flood of 1889 hit the city and took the lives of over 2,000 people. And I'd grown up in Pittsburgh, and I'd heard about this Johnstown flood much of my life, but I really didn't know what happened. And when I saw those photographs, I saw the scale, the violence of the violence and destruction. I was just curious, what happened? What caused this? And I found the books that were available and had been written about very insufficient and left me with many questions. And so I thought, well, why don't you try and write the book you'd like to be able to read? And that's what got me going. And once I started, I realized this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
So each of your books has been a curiosity of yours?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've never undertaken a subject that I knew much about. Because for me, if I knew all about it, I wouldn't want to write the book. For me, writing the book is a journey. It's a learning adventure, and it's like working on a detective case. And the more you learn, the more you want to learn. The more you know, the more you want to know, and the more questions you have. And also, you find out, you discover things that weren't known. I've never undertaken a book where I didn't discover something that had not been known before, and that's exciting. That's the joy is in the work.
Yeah.
And I feel very much in tune with the Wright brothers in that respect. For them, the joy was in the work. It wasn't in the success or the fame or whatever. It was in the work.
Well, the book you wrote is one of the greats. It's called The Wright Brothers. How did you think of that title, David McCullough?
Well, unfortunately, I can't take credit for it. I had some other titles in mind, but my publisher said, let's just call it The Wright Brothers. In my first book of the Johnstown Flood, I combed through Shakespeare and poetry, trying to find the Bible, trying to find some marvelous phrase that would express the story and the mystery and the importance of the tragedy that human irresponsibility can bring on. And I couldn't come up with a title. And I called my editor and said, sir, I've finished this book, but I can't come up with a title. I'd been working on it for weeks and weeks. He said, oh, no problem of a title with that book. Call it The Johnstown Flood. So there was no problem with the title for this book. My editor said, let's just call it The Wright Brothers.
I greatly appreciate you spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that looking out of my hotel window just now, out over the wonderful panorama of the city of San Francisco, there's a marvelous soaring bird floating on the air up above. And I'll never look at a soaring bird the same way ever again.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.